This episode of the podcast is the first part of a three-part series that will be released over the next 2 weeks. This series totals around 3.5 hours and is a summary of 40 years of martial arts experience going back as far as 1977. Andrew Nerlich has a gold sash in Wing Chun and is a first-degree black belt in jiu-jitsu, training out of Langley's MMA. The first part of this series covers the first 20 years of Andrew's martial arts experience and up to the point where his instructor formed a new school in 1996 and began delving beyond the traditional martial arts he knew and into the realm of jiu-jitsu. The second part of this series will carry on from there and more information will be provided upon its release. Over the next 2 weeks, there will be a lot of content covered and many stories told along the way. For those that don't know, Andrew was a victim of a road rage incident in 2018, which was documented and released on an Australian television show. This is discussed in depth throughout the third and final part of the series. Before the episodes kick off, I would just like to say that it was an absolute honour for me to be able to sit down with Andrew and hear his story firsthand. Andrew was very candid and willing to share the entire story, and I truly hope that you'll enjoy it as much as I enjoyed sitting down and having a chat. Andrew, from the bottom of my heart, you're an absolute legend, and on behalf of the entire School of Higher Jiu-Jitsu and every listener of this podcast, I'd just like to say thank you so much. And to everyone else listening, I hope you all enjoy. Okay, and we are live. Andrew, we're discussing a little bit before we went live here, and you sort of mm-hmm. were giving me a brief overview of your martial arts journey, and you sort of said that it sort of began after your uni and studies and stuff like that. Do you want to give us a brief overview of that sort of aspect?
That's fine. My first job was in Canberra, working for the public service. I didn't really have a strong direction. I just sort of followed the path that was expected. You know, you go to university, didn't have any firm plans, took the sort of first job that sounded reasonable that came along, and I just took it from there. I didn't really have much of a background in sport. I did gymnastics in high school and university, and I surfed. But really, I was looking for some direction. What happened was a guy in our building, after I'd been there for a couple of months, we found out that he did kung fu. His name was David Crook. And, you know, I wasn't in his department or anything, but one of the sort of more gregarious people in our department sort of got him to come and give a few of us introductory lessons in the park across the road from work. So that started off. There was probably about five of us. He charged us $1 each to train us each session. And probably after about 3 weeks, everyone else had dropped out except for me and another guy who was already training another martial art. And I spent 18 months training with him in Canberra. Most of that was private, just me and him either in the park across from work or one of his other students' houses. The deal was that he'd provide the instruction, the other guy would provide the venue, and I'd buy a couple of bottles of beer. And we'd sort of, we'd train for an hour and a half, and then we'd sit down and drink the beer, and Dave would tell us stories about kung fu. And after a little while, he decided that he wasn't going to charge me anymore because it was just a good thing for him to do. He didn't have a formal class at the time. He does now, and he sort of really started one just before I left. And he's been teaching for like 50 years now, which is, you know, incredibly long. Yeah. For someone in martial arts.
So before, I know you're going to carry on, but can you give me a just as a reference, what year would this have been when you began?
This is 1977.
Right.
And I stayed in Canberra until sort of towards the end of 1978.
Yeah, so you're 18 months of training under him.
Yeah.
Right, okay. And do you have any interesting stories from that period when you're with him?
Not really story so much. I mean, it was all good.
Mm.
You know, I was incredibly lucky to meet someone at such a high level. He was fairly unique, especially for traditional martial arts people of that time. You know, you're in a small town, normally someone else that teaches martial arts come along, you're sort of, oh, this guy's going to take all my students and, you know, he might challenge me and all this sort of stuff. And David had sort of, he'd ring the guy up and say, oh, welcome to Canberra, good luck. If there's anything I can do to help you out, let me know. He even had a guy, Neil Hardy, who was struggling to get off the ground, and David let him train at his sort of training sessions for a while just with his own students.
Yeah.
And he ran, he was always reaching out to other martial artists of any style.
Mm-hmm.
He ran a camp for well over a decade, like once a year, called Camp David.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after where the, you know, the president used to meet with overseas leaders in America, sort of thing, Camp David. And, you know, anyone could come along. It didn't matter what they did. They did karate, they did tai chi, whatever they did, everyone was welcome.
Right.
And so, you know, that's quite unusual in martial arts. In fact, it's quite unusual in most fields. Most people are all about competing and keeping secrets and getting an edge, but David was all about inclusion.
Mm.
I probably should say the style he did was a style he'd sort of developed himself. Before he started doing Chinese martial arts, he was a second degree black belt in karate, Goju Ryu karate, and he also had a first degree black belt in Japanese jiu-jitsu. For a kung fu guy, one of the styles he did had quite a good grappling component in it. It wasn't groundwork, but it was, stand-up grappling, wrist locks, some arm locks, neck cranks, all sorts of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the three styles David did, I'm sort of rambling a little here, I suppose, but he did Wing Chun, which is a very direct, straightforward, straight line style.
Mm-hmm.
Cholo foot, which is a much more circular and multi-directional sort of style. And Northern Silam, or Northern Shaolin, which is very acrobatic style with a lot of kicking and that sort of thing in it. So blending those together, you could have options for dealing with different types of fighters. Like, you know, if you met someone that liked to fight in close, like a Wing Chun style, you unleash Choi Lo Fat on them because Choi Lo Fat's got a lot of stuff that confounds Wing Chun.
Right.
You've got a long range fighter, you get inside them and beat them up with Wing Chun. You've also got options to kick from a distance and that sort of thing. So it gave you a lot of flexibility in dealing with different opponents.
Yeah.
I really, because it was the first thing I'd ever done, I had no idea how privileged and lucky I was to train with someone with such a breadth of experience, background, and generosity, because I was really treated well, unbelievably so. And anyway,
can I ask you?
Yes.
Even before we went live on the podcast, we were talking for about maybe 45 minutes, and you spoke about David Crook a bit, and from I could gather that you obviously looked up to him a lot, and you still do. You spoke very highly of him.
Yeah.
I want to ask, and I know we're going to go through your whole journey, and it's, you know, we're spanning, you know, when we reference that those stories you're telling now, we're talking about 40 years ago, your first exposure to martial arts. Are there any key philosophies from that 18 months that you still carry today in the way that you interact with people, in the way that you learn martial arts? I know you refer to yourself as a student still.
Yes.
So anything that you've still carried from that time?
I think probably what I learned was that David was an extremely down-to-earth and practical guy. Even from the first lesson, he'd sort of like sink in a punch every now and then, like he'd give you a tap in the solar plexus or something, and most people couldn't deal with that, and I thought, oh, he hit me in the solar plexus and I'm not falling down, my head didn't explode. I think I can do this stuff. I can take the knocks. And my background, I thought I was pretty much a wimp, but it turned out that I wasn't, and I could see maybe I can become a warrior here, make a different sort of future for myself.
Right.
With a bit of help, obviously.
Yeah, a bit of help and direction.
But also that, there isn't a complete martial art, and that every martial art has something to offer.
One
of his teachers was William Chung, and they sort of had a falling out, which is sort of, I don't want to say anything bad about William Chung because he's an excellent martial artist, but he is a, by all accounts, a difficult man to work for,
right,
and or be subordinate to. And David was very clear that he wanted to go his own direction, and they had a bit of a bust up, sort of. It was in public as well, so, and it was a little bit funny to hear the story told, but I wasn't there, so I don't want to sort of go into too much detail.
Yeah.
But that I mentioned William Chung because he's sort of a thread that goes through most of my martial arts career. Basically, he was his own man. He'd work stuff out for himself. And when it comes down to it, you're responsible for your own direction.
Yeah.
And your own progress and whatever you achieve. It's great if you can get people to help you, and a lot of people will love to help you, but essentially it's all down to you. You've got to make it happen. You can't rely on other people.
I think that applies to all facets of life.
I can't disagree with that. That's certainly true.
So you understand you spent about 18 months training with David Crook.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if there's anything else you want to share in that regard, but if we were to continue down the, your journey, how would we move forward from there after that 18 months?
The only other thing I'll say about David, and I may have already said it as much already, is he's right up there with the best, and he set an example that was very hard for anyone else that I dealt with to live up to. That's what I'll say about him. I moved back to Sydney. As I say, Canberra is not a great place for a single person. Certainly not back then. There was like one nightclub in the whole city.
Right.
At weekends, the main drag is pretty much deserted. Nobody's in the shops. It was quite unbelievable in a lot of ways.
Did you think it would be like that when you initially moved down there?
No, I had no idea what to expect, but I just sort of came to the realisation. I sort of went home and down the coast for a holiday, and I'd sort of, you know, made hardly any friends in Canberra, and I made, like, on this holiday I made heaps of instant friends, you know, had a sweet holiday romance, all this sort of stuff. So I'm thinking, well, I don't think it's me. And so, yeah, I moved back home. Most of the people I'd met there were in Sydney, and yeah, I was still doing gymnastics socially as an outlet. I taught it when I was in Canberra a little as well, but sort of, yeah, nothing really happened there personally for me. I always felt like an outsider.
Right. I can understand that.
Yeah.
So you obviously decided to move back to Sydney.
Yes.
From Canberra. And what's, did you, you know, obviously being passionate about what you were doing then, did you immediately try to seek what you're going to do next, or did you, you know, what was the key focus?
Yeah.
And how did you then carry on with your martial arts journey a little bit later?
David gave me sort of a few places to explore, but for various reasons, none of them seemed to work for me. He gave me a guy's name I've met a couple of times that was living in Sydney. He was in the army.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Michael Quinn. And we used to train at his place or in Centennial Park for a while. He was living at Kingsford. His brother-in-law was living in a squat in sort of Darlinghurst/Woolloomooloo. It's where the Eastern Distributor is now. They probably had it earmarked for destruction for like decades before then. And some old guy called Lawrence, he probably wasn't that old. I probably just thought he was old. He was probably younger than I am now. But he used to come to this squat and teach, and, you know, all the people from the squat sort of did kung fu, or some of them anyway. I could never work out who was living there, who was visiting. He just walked in off the street.
Mm.
And, yeah, that was pretty sort of funky. One day we were sort of training out the back, and there was a heavy bag sort of set up in the living room of the house, and some guy on ice wasn't real popular there, but it might have been ice or PCP or something. Some guy burst in and he started screaming and he started wailing away on the punching bag, and yeah, the instructor and everyone else sort of went inside, and I heard all this yelling, and yeah, eventually he, they got him out the door and back to whatever savage fate destiny had in store for him, sort of thing. So that was a pretty average sort of day. Another time I'm sort of walking there, and there's, you know, this blonde girl and a couple of guys sort of walking up the street looking pretty normal. But when I came out, they're coming back the other way and they're sort of looking like people out of The Walking Dead. You know, they'd obviously met up with their dealer or whatever.
Mm.
And, you know, that was sort of the vibe. There was a tap in the backyard, and people of both sexes had come in and sort of wash under the tap.
Mm.
You know, so it was pretty sort of basic. And, you know, I'm not a prude, but, you know, it's, you know, some naked woman having a shower under a tap while you're trying to do 100 punches is pretty damn distracting.
Yeah, and I mean, you obviously weren't, you know, you're in that environment because you're trying to learn martial arts.
Yeah.
You're not, you know, you yourself were just a normal person who's healthy and got a house to go to.
Yeah, I was just a working stiff with a job, and I was paying rent and, you know, all the normal sort of stuff.
Mm.
And, you know, these basically weren't my people. Yeah, me and Michael, we sort of decided, we stuck it out maybe 6 months, but we decided, you know, this is a bit too ghetto for us.
Mm.
And he eventually got moved with the army. He went to Queensland, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was sort of on my own. I had been for a brief time to a school, I'm going to use a pseudonym for this guy, called... I call him Rex King. And actually, to segue from one to the other, Michael Quinn actually changed his name. His original name was Michael Coxhead, but he'd sort of got married and, you know, had a child on the way, and he thought, not sure I want my kid to grow up with that surname and get, sure, you know, nicknamed Dickhead and whatever else at school all the time.
Yeah.
So he changed his name to Michael Quinn, mm-hmm, which, yeah, I understand. But this other school I went to it for about 3 months, and I thought, nah, this is a little bit weird. But I'll put it in the back of my mind in case sort of nothing else comes up. The guy that ran it, I'll call him Rex King. And the name changed things significant because the name that he called himself was of sort of that sort of ilk, like royalty.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in charge, I'm a leader, I'm number one sort of thing.
Mm.
But his name before that, there was nothing wrong with the name he had before that, but it was just didn't seem to have the necessary charisma
that he
or whatever of
wanted to portray.
How he perceived himself and wanted everyone else to see him. So I didn't really feel I had any other options, so I went to Rex King School. And he was all about the mystery, right? The training, it was very good from a fitness point of view. We did lots of calisthenics. We're near where the Mercura Hotel is down near Central Railway.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to do all these calisthenics. Then we'd go outside in black uniforms with bare feet, and we'd run around this sort of figure eight between the buildings,
yep,
three times. You know, in black uniforms and bare feet, looking pretty weird, I'd imagine.
To everyone else.
Yeah, to normal people. And then we go inside and we do technique. And really the technique was pretty basic. Rex's idea was that, you know, you had to train for years and prove your worth and, you know, basically put up with him for however long it took, which you never knew how long it was going to take. And, yeah, that went on for years. And, yeah, he had... his personal life was a bit of a train wreck. He'd already had two marriages and four kids.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his second marriage was to a female student who was, you know, blonde, tall, absolutely beautiful. And, yeah, he had four lovely kids. I just wonder how those kids got on after I went growing up. But, yeah, just to give you some idea of his form sort of thing, we moved from that place to another place, and he sort of went in with this Japanese jiu-jitsu guy who was like he was a nice guy. He took a couple of classes and, yeah, we got to talking a bit. I quite liked him. But he had this, yeah, really stunning girlfriend as well. And when they went in there, Rex was a chiropractor and acupuncturist.
Right.
So, yeah, he was making a fairly good income.
Yeah.
And he was fairly busy with this, and he hired this girlfriend to be his receptionist. But, yeah, a couple of months go by, Rex has stolen this guy's girlfriend away from him. And they're supposed to be in business together.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think they eventually got married, but that was after I left. But just, you know, that just made the whole thing really, really awkward.
Mm.
And, yeah, this guy didn't know what hit him. You know, it just totally blindsided him. And he was, I think, was shattered for a little while. Yeah.
I'm sure he was. And so how long were you training with him for?
Close to 5 years I would have been there. But there's other stories as well, just things he used to do. He did Xingyi, Bagua and Tai Chi, which are three internal styles, as they're called, of Kung Fu, which is a little bit about the chi and the you know, softness and all this sort of stuff. Didn't go as far as chi blasts, but it's sort of on the way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
There was a you know, something he'd never taught to people before, or so he said. Bagua is sort of where you walk around in a circle for your training and do what are called palm changes and sort of glide and swoop and spin in circles and stuff like that. But there was this linear style which he'd never taught to anyone before. But he started teaching us that, and you know, someone in the class who, you know, he had the shits with, which sort of happened regularly, or you know, it was the other way around. This guy was, you know, starting to get fed up with him and was starting to get ready to go, sort of thing. But he said something, and it was fairly innocuous, but you know, Rex sort of cracked the shits and just said, right, that's it. I don't think you guys are ready for this anymore. I'll maybe get around to it some other time. And sort of, you know, it's just sort of like, oh, shit, you know?
Yeah.
Like that. Okay, the best story, and hopefully your listeners will find this amusing. It's fairly embarrassing. We had this thing to do where we had to go on a special diet, which was basically no dairy, no meat, no gluten, that's like no wheat, no bread, you know, coffee and alcohol out of the question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and yeah, you weren't supposed to have sex or, you know, self-relief or anything like that for the period that we did with this diet, which I think was about a month, but it seemed like about a year. You know, and like, I was having problems with, she was my girlfriend at the time, not big problems, but, you know, we were having difficulties, mainly because of my association with Rex. She sort of hated him on sight, which shows how sensible she is. But, you know, we go through this, you know, regime of denial, which is... it's very hard to buy lunch in the city under those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, you know, I'll let you know now I cheated on the diet. As little as possible, but you know, I'd be dead. I would have died of starvation otherwise. I lost a heap of weight.
In 1 month.
Yeah, anyway, the upshot of this is, and this is for the male students, the female students had to do something else. And none of them would tell us what it was for reasons that'll become apparent in a minute. But after all that time and all that abstinence, we were supposed to we had the little brown medicine bottle, and we were supposed to produce a specimen of a particular bodily fluid, right? The white one.
Yeah. Understood. Yep. Understood.
Anyway, you do that, which of course was enormously relieving at the time, and you know, you put that in a refrigerated bag and you rush it into the quern, as it was, which is like the gym, right? And we put them all in this fridge and we wait, and nothing's happening. Yeah, after a while you know, other things happen, you know, other crises in the gym. Personality conflicts or whatever. Yeah, months go by. These bottles all get encrusted with ice. There's a couple of power outages. Yeah, all the labels fall off the bottles, so you don't know whose is whose anymore. And yeah, eventually the school moves, and yeah, on route to the new school, the whole fridge with all the bottles in it disappears, and nothing's ever said about this again. And like, no one wants to bring it up because it's just too weird. And you know, if you bring it up, Rex is gonna, you know, he's gonna go mental. And yeah, so that was just, you know, that was just totally absurd.
Does anyone know what he was trying to get out of it?
No. I doubt it very much. I don't know if even he knew what he was trying to get out of it. I really can't imagine what the purpose of it was. And yeah, God knows what the female students had to do.
You still don't know today?
No, none of them would talk about it. You know, you go, you know, this thing we were, don't want to know, not going to tell you. Yeah. So yeah, would have been similarly weird and embarrassing, I'd imagine. So yeah, that was, that's the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me in martial arts. Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's... You're lucky he didn't start teaching you chi blasts, because, you know, it would have there's no returning from that, from there to that, and then you know, you're too far down the hole to recover. Yeah.
Anyway, I had some good times with those guys. I had some guys I regarded as good friends that were there, and women. I went to Asia with him and probably 20 other people, and we had fun there. And Hong Kong, Shanghai, Japan, Taipei. So saw Kung Fu in all those places.
Yeah.
To be honest, at that time, with the Cultural Revolution, it had just basically destroyed Kung Fu in mainland China.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We saw a few people, but there was only one person I saw in Shanghai. We got up early to go to the park, People's Park, and there was this old lady there. When I say old lady, I'm an old man now, and she was probably about 40 or something.
Mm.
But she was doing splits in every direction, and she was doing this bagua where you're walking in a circle, and she had these funny hooked swords that they do it with, and she was just fantastic. But, yeah, everyone else was just doing super basic stuff, which could have been because, you know, we were foreign devils or whatever and they didn't want to show us the good stuff. But, I sort of realised, you know, everything I could get over here I could probably get in Australia I wanted.
Yeah.
And which is not to say it wasn't really interesting. It's always great to travel, right?
Yeah. So even though you were starting to get sceptical of... Rex King himself, you still, you know, got some good experiences, notwithstanding some of the weird stuff.
Yeah, I mean, life's about experience. Yeah, everyone does stupid things at some stage. Yeah, if you don't take, you know, stupid chances sometimes, you know, you haven't really lived, I don't think.
Mm.
And, yeah, you learn by making mistakes. And, yeah, I don't regret it, because a lot of it was a lot of fun and it was good.
Mm.
And I enjoyed it.
How long? I'm not sure if there's more to discuss about that point in time. But how long were you actually training with him for?
It was close to 5 years. I came very close to becoming an instructor, but you know, I'm thinking, well, from what I've learned, there isn't really that much to teach. You know, he was getting into some weird sort of sales practices and stuff to try and get new members in, and sort of like, you know, you have to commit to sign up 3 new people this month, and you know, all of this sort of rubbish. And I'm just thinking, nah, I've had enough of this.
Mm.
And so I sort of stopped training martial arts for a while, got into my career, which wasn't going all that great, but once I concentrated on it, it picked up remarkably quickly.
Mm.
I work in IT. I was mainly a programmer, but I worked in mainframe and mini computer operations, and I was managed up to about 15 people in various roles and that sort of thing.
Mm.
So that started to work out, and my girlfriend, who was the one that hated Dean, I was working with her, and you know, we got close. We got married in 85, and yeah, that was all good. And I, you know, my physical outlet then was surfing mainly. Mm. And so I did that for a few years. About probably mid to late 1988, I know it sounds like I'm making it up, but it's actually true. I had a dream about, I was living close to Canberra and I could drive to Canberra and do classes in martial arts with David Crook. And I woke up and, yeah, it's not like a lightning bolt to the head or anything, but you think, yeah, you know, I do sort of miss that. Mm. And so I started looking around, and Rick Spain, who was a student of William Chung, who I've mentioned before, who was David Crook's original instructor and the instructor of the guy that was in the squat in Darlinghurst. He was in Sydney, He had a very good reputation. Before I started training with him, he'd had like 100 kickboxing matches in Melbourne, 37 pro fights. He won a World Kung Fu Championship in Hong Kong in 1982. And he absolutely was a great technician, extremely good fighter. I went and had a look at his score, and he was great. All his students looked competent. Yeah, there wasn't, there weren't any slackers there, sort of thing. Mm. People that couldn't do stuff that were just sort of along for the ride. And I thought, I could do this. And so I did. And I've been training with him mostly on, but on and off for 30 years now, nearly. Let's see. Through all of this, I had a few physical challenges. I have sort of a damaged lumbar vertebra.
Mm.
And while I'm not at the stage that, the guy that John Smalios interviewed recently,
mm-hmm.
Sava.
From Leverage Jiu-Jitsu in Melbourne.
Yeah, I don't have the level of challenges that he does. I actually train with another very good black belt at Laney's called Andre Powell, who's legally blind.
Wow.
And, he's super technical, super sneaky. Give him an inch and he's got you tapping.
Mm.
Very sneaky. Very good at jiu-jitsu. And he competes. This is awesome. I had a few challenges, particularly with kicking, and I got attracted to martial arts. A lot of it was sort of just the beauty of movement sort of thing,
mm.
and particularly, high kicks, roundhouse kicks and side kicks and stuff like that. And with the way my back was, I hadn't stretched for years because it hurt, and I had a lot of problems with that. And somehow I still managed to get through it all, even though I was sort of hating myself for not being able to kick properly and stuff like that. Mm. After a while at Rick's, he's saying, look, you got to work something out with your kicks. It was after a grading, I think. He said, you're doing good, but your kicks are letting you down. You got to work something out. And I've always been an inveterate reader. I had magazines by the truckload and books and everything else. There was no internet back then.
Mm.
And, all you had was magazines and books, and you'd get one and you'd sort of devour it and just practice it for months because that's all you had. And I sort of started working through all this stuff, and I got on the kitchen bench and I just sort of worked through where I could move my legs and my hips and everything and get in the right position. And eventually I think I worked something out, and I started going back and I started, kicking the bags and that sort of stuff. And Rick sort of said, hey, you got a sidekick now. This is good, And, this guy was holding the kicking shield. He goes, gives me the thumbs up.
Yeah.
And, roundhouse kicks were a bit more complicated. Rick sort of said to me, just when you're sparring, stick to front kicks and side kicks because, didn't say this, but your roundhouse kicks suck, sort of thing. And I already had like a heavy bag, and I strung it over a tree in my backyard. I was living in a house then, sort of thing, so I could do that. And I just spent hours in the backyard working on roundhouse kicks. And eventually they started to come. I had a lot of problems still with my back. I went to chiropractors for about 15 years,
mm-hmm.
and they sort of slowly worked some of the problems I had out. But Yeah, I do like a hard kicking workout or something, I'd be sore for days.
Yeah.
Sometimes I even needed a walking stick to get around.
Jeez.
And so, yeah, this was frustrating.
I can imagine, yeah.
And yeah, a lot of my kung fu career was frustration, you know. And, yeah, mind you, I'm sure it's not as tough for me as some other people. I guess the point is that eventually you start something difficult like this, you'll come across limitations that you have in your body or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to get past those to get to
where you want
to
go.
Where you need to go, where you want to go. And, yeah, for me it was where it's, is a good place for you to get to, because eventually I did, you know, change tack, went to a physio. He was fantastic. He didn't do any adjustments, but he got me doing all these exercises because I had like muscle imbalances and stuff because of my injury.
Yeah.
And he just worked on those for 3 months. And yeah, I've had minor episodes of back pain since, but yeah, it's basically been a clear run from them. And yeah, I worked out the problems I had with flexibility. I was never a great kicker, and I was never going to be, but you know, I did manage to pop a few people in the head with roundhouse kicks, and you know, fake the low kick and kick them high off the same leg and stuff like that. So you know, I felt I'd
started to become competent.
Yeah. But also, you know, the limitation that I had, I felt I'd sort of transcended.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, that's, you know, people talk about surpassing your limitations, and you know, I felt I had an actual physical limitation, and I actually found a way past that. And the impetus for that was because I wanted to get good at martial arts.
Yeah.
And I got reasonably good at martial arts, but in order to get there I had to sort of heal myself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it wasn't all me, but if I hadn't have done martial arts, I'd probably still have this, you know, same problem with my back, and I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't have the freedom, and I wouldn't have the accomplishments I have today. So I can't sort of understate how it sort of brought that transformation within me out.
Yeah.
I know that sounds sort of airy-fairy, but it's real.
Not at all. It's like in business and in life, like you need to understand your why.
Yeah.
And the, you know, your why was that you wanted to get good at martial arts.
Yeah.
So you just did what it took.
Yeah.
But it obviously took quite a while to get past it.
But on the way, you know, I transcended some limitations that I had, which was like, you know, that was probably even better in a lot of ways. You know, one's great, the other's great, but you know, they were both, one was like the added bonus.
Yeah.
You know, and that was fantastic.
So let me ask you, I was reading our notes earlier, and you mentioned quite early in the notes that your back injury.
Yep.
You mentioned it was something lumbar. Was there an actual incident or thing that occurred that caused it initially?
It's hard to say, but I think I had, you know, feeling mucking around at a school swimming carnival. I had like a bad fall off the platform at Balmoral Bars, and I landed on my back.
Yeah.
And this doesn't feel good. And I went to a GP, and yeah, this is way before orthopedic science and keyhole surgery and all this sort of stuff we have today. And it was just, you've probably done something, just don't do anything physical for 6 weeks and we'll see how you are then. And that was it.
Yeah, just rest, walk it off.
Basically, yeah. But even you know, I've had, I injured one of my knees in like the late 70s, and you know, all it was either you get your knee ripped open or you just let it get better.
Yeah.
And same thing. I had a separated shoulder with surfing, and I just didn't do anything about it. I realise now that it was a separated shoulder because I got the other one through jiu-jitsu. And yeah, but that I had better treatment for and understood what was going on.
Yeah, later on in life.
Yeah, I don't know if you can notice here, and it's not going to make any sense on a podcast, but you can see my collarbone there sticking up.
Yeah, it's quite like protruding collarbone.
It doesn't hurt, it doesn't affect me anymore, but you know, I'm sort of basically Quasimodo here, folks.
Not quite, but yeah, there's a little bit of a bump there that I can see that.
Yeah.
So the back injury, how long? What's the? I know you were talking about, you know, training around it and stuff, but what sort of time frame are we talking here between, you know, it being an issue and you feeling like you'd gotten past it?
It really was an issue from day one back in Canberra. I just couldn't do the kicks right, and David was a very good instructor, but you know, he didn't really. It's not his fault. It's not his fault. It's my fault. I didn't push it or he didn't push it, but, you know, your kicks suck. You need to do something about them.
Mm.
It was only sort of when Rick said that to me, I thought, well, okay, this is sort of make or break time. I'm sort of in the mirror maze and all I'm seeing around me is unflattering reflections of myself.
Mm.
And I've got to do something about this.
Yeah.
And I did. You know, but you sort of... It's so hard with things like that to sort of find the right sort of window where what you need appears and you can grab it sort of thing. It's like sliding doors, I suppose. You know, there's just, or, you know, someone's driving past you in a car and they've got a message for you, but it's all over so quick because they're going one way and you're going the other sort of thing. But anyway... It worked out, and yeah, a lot of that was just me being too sort of stubborn and whatever to stop.
Yeah. Let me ask, have you mentioned your instructor qualification?
That was
around the same sort of time frame, right?
Yeah, after 7 years with Rick Spain, and while he was still with William Chung, who's one of the sort of... the current, if you like, grandmasters.
Yeah.
Although that's sort of a made-up title for all of them, Wing Chun, these days. But he is one of the sort of pivotal figures from Hong Kong, you know, going back to Ip Man, who you've probably heard of.
Yeah.
Watched the movie
at Melbourne Camp with Higher Jiu-Jitsu. Yeah. We watched it.
Yeah, he's one of... He's one of sort of Ip Man's most famous students, if you like.
Right.
But, you know, trouble with Wing Chun is they all hate each other and, you know, they all bag each other out incessantly and say they're all charlatans and, you know, this goes on all the time and it's really sort of regrettable with Wing Chun.
Mm.
But, you know, it's quite obvious Rick was the real deal. David Crook only had... good things to say about William's fighting ability. He said he was the best fighter he'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
I have heard stories from various sources of, you know, he was sort of like he was Chinese back in the 60s and 70s and, you know, not a shrinking violet and, you know, people would sort of he'd start fights with them or they'd start fights with him and, you know, he'd just wipe the floor with them with no apparent effort. But, you know, he had a few unfortunate experiences. There's a very famous Wing Chun incident that happened in Europe where sort of one of the bigger rival schools, if you like, are in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a setup, and the guy that did it basically admitted later that, you know, his sort of instructors had sort of said, you're going to go here and you're going to attack William Chung sort of thing.
Yeah.
William Chung, I should say. And he did attack him, and it was on a slippery floor, and he had, you know, the kung fu shoes on. So eventually it became a ground fight. And... I won't say he had no ground skills, but whatever ground skills he had didn't really help him with that. And, they got it on film and it all looked terrible and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that, in a nutshell, sums up Wing Chun. You know, everyone hates each other. Nobody talks to each other. You stick with your own group and, you know, basically everyone else is the enemy sort of thing, which is very different to jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, that almost, you know, I don't know much about Wing Chun, but I've watched Ip Man, and I think that, you know, that's the basis behind that as well.
Yeah. But, you know...
it's a part of it, I'm sure. I mean, there's more to it than that, but yeah.
But, you know, I got pretty well in. I didn't compete because I was already sort of, you know, pushing 40.
Mm.
But, you know, his students did quite well in kickboxing at the time, such as it was in Australia. Excuse me.
It's okay.
And I was confident I was in a good school, you know. We did, you know, hard sparring. I got knocked out. I got lots of sort of peripheral injuries, you know, nothing else sort of too serious, but getting knocked out was a bit of a trip, you know.
Mm.
And it's very dangerous, by the way.
It's not nice, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, Rick's father died. He was attacked outside a place he was staying and sort of just got up and shook it off, went upstairs, went to bed and never woke up. So kids, if you get knocked out, go to hospital, basically. Getting choked out's different. You know, I've seen lots of people get choked out. I've almost been tempted to let it happen to me just to see how it felt, sort of thing. It's not happened. But other people say, oh, you go to this happy place.
Mm.
I don't know if that's true or not, but getting knocked out's very different. I had sort of short-term memory loss, which gradually sort of came back. Like, I woke up sitting in this chair and I just heard, how did I get here?
Mm.
Where I'm at the Kung Fu. How did I get here? And it all sort of gradually sort of came back, what I've been doing that day and stuff like that. And like Rick's friend Ivan Lynch drove me home, and yeah, he had to get a taxi back, which was very good of him. But yeah, that was a trip. I've had a fair bit of dental work, some of which is. A fair bit of it's due to bad dental hygiene and not going to the dentist for over a decade. But some of it's definitely due from, you know, getting punched in the jaw and stuff like that. Mm. So kids, go to the dentist and get a good mouth guard, especially if you're doing striking. So where are we? Instructor qualification 95. It's sort of, there are 10 grading levels. 10th level, you get a gold sash, you get a certificate signed by William Chung, and that's still up on my wall to this day. 96, I climb up the stairs. We're on the second floor in a building in Surry Hills. We're there for about 25 years. Everyone's walking around, there's a sort of, the air is sort of electric. And Rick wasn't there for reasons you'll find out in a moment, because William Chung was running a seminar there, and somebody asked him a question that he objected to, and he sort of spat the dummy, and Rick came in to defend his student. And Rick was on, like, crutches at the time because he'd had an ankle operation.
Right.
And so they weren't ever going to fight, though. People on the internet said that, you know, there was a big fight and stuff like that, but there wasn't.
Mm.
But, you know, William Chung sort of stormed out and Rick went after him, and I just missed this. And I said to everyone, well, what's going on? And they told me, you know, that we were doing the seminar, and then, you know, he got the shits with so-and-so, and then Rick got up and talked to him, and then he stormed out and Rick went after him, and so here we are. And yeah, Rick came back after a while and sort of explained to me what had happened, because I was probably the ranking guy there at the moment. I'd been teaching probably since about 93, maybe a little earlier, because I was a senior student. I taught at Rex King's as well, you know, I got sort of close to the top there, I suppose. And yeah, just to digress for a minute, you know, you do anything for sort of long enough, you know, you start at the back of the class, you're at the end of the line, and like I think Oscar was saying on his podcast, you know, eventually you stay there long enough and keep doing the work, you know, you're sort of at the front of the line, you're at the front of the class.
Yeah.
You're the, you know, you're one of the top dogs.
Mm.
You know, and that can happen to anybody with just about everything if you stick at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's very hard to become a UFC champion because you're like the top 0.00001%.
Yeah.
Right? But I don't think it's that hard to become one of the top 1%.
Yeah.
If you stick at something for 10 years, you're going to be, you know, on the top level sort of thing. You won't be at the top necessarily without natural gifts, but, you know, you can become pretty damn good at anything in 10 years.
Yep.
Yeah, and jiu-jitsu, whatever.
I mean, jiu-jitsu in 3 years, the amount of stuff I've learned compared to what I didn't know anything at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if I versed myself now versus before I'd started,
yeah,
I mean, it'd be like playing with Play-Doh.
Yeah. Anyway, so we busted up then. Rick went out on his own.
Mm.
I mentioned the thing with him coming in to talk to me because he said, look, we'll be leaving the organisation. Can you take the next class? I'm just going to try and find Sifu, William Chung, and see if we can sort anything out. So I actually took the first class for Rick's new school, right, which is,
history.
Know me sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's, I have a certain amount of pride about that. What else happened there? So we went out on our own. That gave Rick a lot of freedom to do other things. It also took a little bit of a, you know, the burden of being a franchisee off him.
That concludes the first part of the three-part series. Episode 2 is due to be released in the next few days, which begins after the formation of Rick Spain's new school in 1996, and from there it will carry on through to 2018. We will see you in a few days, and I hope that you tune in again, and I hope that you enjoyed the episode so far. Thank you, everyone.